Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to the fourth in our series of events on labor and globalization. The talk that we're going to hear today is about the history of migrant farm labor, and I believe the focus will be on California. But before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to say a few words about migrant farm labor today in New York State. Agriculture is New York State's largest industry. This should not surprise anyone who lives around here, where we can see that agriculture is big business. Yet agricultural workers, farmhands, poultry workers, fruit pickers, and dairy workers are expressly excluded from the labor legislation which protects workers in other industries. This means that New York's farm workers, including roughly 47,000, although I hear different estimates, it's very hard to estimate how many migrant farm workers there are, 47,000 seasonal migrant workers from Central America, the Caribbean, and elsewhere, endure working conditions which are so objectionable that they have been outlawed for other workers. Farm workers are excluded from the guarantees of disability insurance, overtime pay, a day of rest, and health and safety regulations which workers in other industries take for granted. Most importantly, farm workers are not guaranteed the right to organize unions and bargain collectively, rights guaranteed to other workers in the state constitution. This means that when agricultural workers try to press their employers as a group for better wages or working conditions, for protection against harmful pesticides, better housing, overtime pay, or a day off each week, their employers can fire them with legal impunity. In our region of the state, seasonal workers pick fruit, apples, peaches, strawberries, in the Finger Lakes region, and especially near Rochester, work in the vineyards on Cayuga, Seneca, and Cuca Lakes, and pick sweet corn right down the road from the college, where there's a large encampment of Haitian migrant workers. The seasonal workers in our area were, for years, African-American migrants from the southern U.S. Today, they are mostly from Central America, especially Mexico, and the Caribbean, especially Haiti. Year-round farm workers milk cows on the many dairy farms in our region, like my partner Joe milks cows for a living. He's not a migrant, but he's a farm worker, and he's not protected by all those same laws, right? Conditions for all farm workers are exacerbated by the fact that many farm workers are undocumented immigrants. Employers often take advantage of workers' immigration status to impose harsh conditions on workers. Many migrant workers who are documented are legally in the category of guest workers. The government's H-2A program, which restricts those workers to work only for the employers who brought them here, this also creates opportunity for abuse, since employers can not only fire such workers but also have them deported. Clearly, though, whether documented or undocumented, migrant workers are indispensable to the agricultural industry and should be regarded and treated as such by labor law and by their employers. On May 2nd, hundreds of farm workers and their supporters will head for Albany for a day of lobbying and activism to address these legal disparities. The annual effort is known as Farm Worker Advocacy Day and has had considerable success over the years in pressuring the state legislature to bring the laws protecting agricultural workers into line with those affecting workers in other industries. In 1996, the legislature was persuaded to pass legislation requiring employers to supply drinking water in the fields to workers. In 1998, they passed legislation requiring employers to provide a toilet if they have more than 5 employees. Last year, the legislature finally raised the minimum wage for farm workers so that it is the same as the federal minimum wage, and that just went into effect quite recently. But these very successes in such basic areas as sanitation, drinking water, and the minimum wage indicate how dire the situation of farm workers has been. And there is more to be done. Farm workers continue to be excluded from numerous other areas of New York State's labor laws. They're in the areas of overtime pay, disability insurance, safety training, heat stress, pesticides, housing codes, and so on. In some cases, these disparities are due to provisions in the labor laws explicitly excluding farm labor. In other cases, the legislature has enacted separate laws providing less protection and coverage for farm workers. This year's Farm Worker Advocacy Day is targeting several of the disparities, including those having to do with collective bargaining, overtime pay, disability, day of rest, housing conditions, and pesticides. Legislators have submitted individual bills for each of these issues, but activists and their advocates are hoping to pass the omnibus bill, the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act, which would completely equalize the labor laws and public health laws protecting farm workers. passage of the omnibus bill would eliminate the disparities between the laws covering farm workers and those covering other workers. Lobbyists for the industry defend the legal disparities by claiming that there is something special or exceptional about the agricultural industry, that it is seasonal, that it's somehow more socially essential than other industries, that its profit margins are not large enough to support better wages and working conditions for workers, or the risk of labor actions like strikes. But seasonal workers in any other industry, tourism, for example, are free to organize unions and bargain collectively. Equally essential workers, teachers, firefighters, nurses, are free to form unions. There's no good reason to treat farm workers differently. Farm lobbyists have also argued that equalizing the labor laws would hurt the family farm, quote unquote. But farming in New York State is big business. True family farms rarely employ anyone outside the immediate family, or not typically. What's at stake for the farm lobby are the profits of big agribusiness and not family farms. Agricultural workers in other states have been allowed to unionize for years. The United Farm Workers secured the right to bargaining protection for farm workers in California in the 70s, yet in California, agriculture has hardly collapsed as an industry. In fact, the industry is huge and profitable, and in fact, 8 times the size of New York's. Clearly, the agricultural industry in New York State could survive the equalization of labor laws for farm workers. In any case, there's no good reason for treating farm workers differently from other workers. Let's hope that this is the year that farm workers and their advocates succeed in erasing the disparities in New York State laws affecting farm workers. Then the people who help put food on our tables can finally move the struggle forward to improve their working conditions and living conditions. Now it's my pleasure to be able to introduce today's speaker. Cleet Daniel is professor of American labor history in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. He is the author of several books, including Bitter Harvest, A History of California Farm Workers. His latest book, Culture of Misfortune, A History of the Struggles of Textile Workers in the United States, will be published by Cornell Press in the fall. He is currently researching a biography of the United Farm Workers Union leader Cesar Chavez. In 1990-91, Professor Daniel chaired the Governor's Task Force on Agricultural Workers in New York State. The report and recommendations of the task force established the foundation for current efforts to redress the legal inequality of farm workers in New York State. Please join me in welcoming Professor Daniel.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. I'm delighted to be here today. I've always had this vague impression that Wells College made a special effort to inculcate among its students concerns for issues of social justice. And if that's true, then I admire you very much. If it's not, then I'm deeply disappointed. I know at Cornell we are permitted to entertain those concerns, but we don't really encourage them. And if they are encouraged here, then I'm very glad to be in your midst. I'm always talking about agriculture workers in the oddest settings. This is not a setting that would come to mind when you're talking about people as historically as degraded, as chronically degraded as agricultural workers. And permit me a moment's self-indulgence. Let me explain how I came to have this interest. I was born and grew up in a town called Salinas, California, which is an awful place. And in fact, everybody I knew in describing it always described it through a resort to anatomical metaphors. The lucky people in California, we thought, were the people who had never heard of the place. The next people in terms of good fortune were people who had passed through the place on their way to some place worth being. And then the third category is the one that we occupied, people who knew the place intimately because we lived there. Salinas, California was a special place in the history of California agriculture because it was an area devoted exclusively to industrialized agriculture, that is, agriculture on a huge commercial corporate scale. There was never any tradition of family farming in and around this town of Salinas. Salinas had one famous citizen in its history. Anybody know who that was? John Steinbeck. But John Steinbeck was never spoken. That name was never spoken while I lived in Salinas. We never read his books in high school. No one ever made reference to the fact that he was born in that city and went to that high school and went on to a distinguished career in the nation and the world as a man of letters. He won the Nobel Prize in the early 1960s for his accomplishments as a writer. He was regarded as a class traitor in my town by the people who ran the town, and they were these minor potentates who ran the agricultural economy of the town. And I grew up always wondering why it was that the town had the character that it did. It was a town in which there was a very obvious and distinct class divide. And where you were in relation to this system determined the character of your life. And I grew up in a working class family. My father was a mechanic, and he worked on the trucks that supported this huge agricultural enterprise. In my neighborhood, there were other people who, it was a neighborhood populated by Dust Bowl migrants from the 1930s, so-called Okies, who worked in agriculture in various capacities, and then by a large number of Mexican and Mexican-American families who worked in other capacities in this system. And I was always curious to know why democracy and capitalism seemed to work out well for some people and less well for others. And I've spent most of my professional career trying to answer that question, not just in the context of the history of agricultural workers, but in the context of other kinds of workers. I wrote a book on the failure of the federal government's wartime anti-discrimination policy, and with a special focus on why it was that Chicano workers in the Southwest derived so little benefit from the public policy of the United States during World War II, which was supposedly a policy of non-discrimination in employment. This recent book I finished on textile workers is a book that tries to explain why textile workers, among all those categories of workers in mass production industries, had so little success in trying to empower themselves, while auto workers and steel workers and other categories of mass production workers were generally succeeding in that. I've always been more interested in losers than in winners, and this preoccupation with farm workers, I think, attests to that. Chris asked me to come today to provide a historical frame of reference that would help you in understanding the historic powerlessness, the historic degradation of agricultural workers as an occupational group. I mean, why is it that agricultural workers as an occupational group have always been and are today utterly powerless, completely degraded as an occupational class? It is at once an easy question to answer and a very hard question to answer. One of the problems with dealing with American agriculture is that it's a very diverse kind of enterprise, so diverse that it makes it very difficult to construct an inclusive, all-encompassing explanation of what has long been euphemistically referred to as the plight of agricultural workers. I mean, you almost never hear that word plight used in any other context. You never hear about the plight of students. Well, my students don't have a plight, I guess, but if they had, it would be called something else. Plight is a word that seems to apply especially to agricultural workers, and it is magnificently euphemistic. You say the word that you don't have to go into the details, which are heart-rending. It's possible, however, when you look carefully at the character of American agriculture over the last 250 years or so, to find in the two separate, sometimes similar but more often dissimilar, strands of American agriculture, some important commonalities and some important differences that help explain, that provide an explanation for this question that I'm always raising. The first of these traditions, the one that comes most readily to mind when we reflect on the history of agricultural enterprise in the United States, is symbolized by the family farm. And it summons up thoughts of a culture and of a lifestyle that embodies some of the most cherished of our national values. Extolled by Thomas Jefferson and other agrarian idealists as the economic pursuit that more than any other nourished and sustained the development of a genuinely democratic character among our people. Family farming conferred special honor and special dignity on those who labored in its cause. It was, as people claimed over and over and over over the last 200 years, a wholesome economic means to a highly valued social and political end. And rather than fostering tensions and conflicts with the burgeoning wage-earning class, the people who invested their lives in family farming more often than not felt a community of interest with other workers. That is, they tended to identify with the working class more than with the property-owning classes of society, despite the fact that they were property owners. The evidence of this can be found throughout the history of this country. The public land policies that were advocated during the 19th century, advocated by people who wanted the best, most arable public lands to be available on a preferential basis to people who would actually settle on the land and make it productive, was an agitation which was spearheaded by both farmers and workers. Farmers because they wanted access to this land, and they were committed to farming on a scale which facilitated and strengthened democracy. Workers because they always saw farming and the relative economic independence it afforded as a means of escape from the degradation, the thraldom of wage slavery, as it was routinely referred to in the 19th century. Both were strong advocates of anti-monopoly policies. That is to say, both farmers and workers believed that that control over wealth in America was being arrogated to a smaller and smaller number of people. And as that class empowered itself, it was not just at the expense of those people who had no power, but it was at the expense of our democratic values and democratic institutions. They joined together for such things as currency reform. The 19th century currency reform was always an issue of debate, and the debate was not a simple debate, but a very complex debate that revealed some of the most enduring tensions in our national life. When the first railroad regulations were imposed in the 1870s, it was as a result of an agitation advanced both by farmers and by workers. Workers because the railroads had become the preeminent mass employers in the United States. Farmers because they believed that they had been victimized economically by the monopoly control that the railroad companies exercised over transportation services, which were, of course, critically important to farmers. The democratic reforms that were celebrated in the so-called progressive era, that is the referendum and the initiative and reform, were strongly advocated by farmers and workers because they believed it was one way that they could loosen the grip of the so-called money classes on our political institutions. In the 1870s, something called the Greenback Labor Party had come into being. So here's a party whose name announces this confederation of workers and farmers. And even today, I don't know that you're familiar with the character politics, for example, in places like North Dakota or Minnesota, but there are farmer labor parties alive today, and they are now a 21st century testament to the enduring power of this notion. Somehow there's an inherent community of interest between people who sell their labor for wages and people who work in agriculture on a small scale, on a family farming scale. Now, most family farmers also employed labor from time to time, as Chris noted, but it was always on a basis that maintained the integrity of family farming. You might need to hire the kid from the next farm over to help you at some busy season during some peak harvest season or something. And you might hire out to your neighboring farmer to help him or her in the same way. But there was no degradation associated with doing this kind of work for wages on a small family farm because you were really occupying a rung at the bottom of the agricultural ladder, and the expectation was that you were being apprenticed to the land, and this apprenticeship was in anticipation of your ascending up that ladder to a position of yeoman freeholder. Independent farmer. Within the larger society, family farming and family farmers were valued for the contributions they made to the country's economic prosperity, to be sure, But they were appreciated as well, and perhaps even more, for sustaining a lifestyle and purveying values that were widely cherished as essential to the health of our democracy. Small farming, one agrarian wrote, is the panacea for about all of the ills of life. It is the solution of all of the most vexed problems of political economy. In that country where the people who own the land cultivate it and govern it, the doctrines of Malthus, Ricardo, and Adam Smith will not apply. Family farming, however, was never the only tradition of agricultural enterprise in the United States. From the time of this country's initial settlement by Europeans in the 1600s, agriculture had also been pursued on a basis that had little or no association with family farming. There was a superficial resemblance to family farming, that is, the content of the work sometimes appeared to be the same. But it was never pursued as a way of life in the way that family farming was. This other tradition, which was from the first overtly and unapologetically commercial in both its structure and its motives, found its earliest and its most forceful expression in the plantation agriculture of the American South. And because it adopted human slavery as its labor system of choice, it demeaned and degraded labor as no other economic enterprise in this country's history has. Although the emancipation of slaves in the 1860s transformed the labor system attendant to plantation agriculture in the South, it did not significantly undermine the tradition of large-scale, labor-intensive commercial farming that plantation agriculture represented. In the late 19th century, however, the locus of this agribusiness tradition, that is, this commercial, industrial-scale farming tradition, did shift to the far West, and especially to California, where the nearly complete absence of a family farming tradition afforded already well-established advocates of large-scale commercial farming a chance to build an agricultural economy that was industrial, both in scale and in outlook. Indeed, in California, the nation was afforded its first look at agriculture in truly modern dress, an enterprise that still had content in common with traditional farming, that is, with family farming, but which revealed a oneness in motives, methods, and sense of unadulterated economic purpose with the burgeoning industrial order. Yet in devising a labor system that was consistent with the needs of their developing industry, agribusiness leaders in California found their inspiration not in the example of urban industry, which competed for workers in a marketplace, but in the example of the plantation South, which, even after the abolition of slavery, sought to maintain through a system of debt peonage what amounted to a captive workforce, that is, a variation on slavery that was not legally defined as slavery, but had the practical consequences and character of slavery. Most agribusinessmen in California never advocated slavery as an answer to their labor problem. Some did, but it was a minority. But in advocating the importation of Chinese workers for their exclusive use, they were advocating the practical equivalent of slavery, expressing a view common to agribusinessmen in California during the late 19th century. One leader argued, the Chinese farm workers should be to California what the African has been to the South. Farmer employers saw in the Chinese, as they would see in a succession of non-white groups in subsequent decades, a workforce ideally suited to their needs. Workers who were said to be, hoped to be, docile, abundant, dispensable, cheap, and by virtue of their race or national origin, ineligible for any other employment. Throughout all of these arguments ran the same theme. Chinese workers, because they were not white, did not, indeed could not, have aspirations or expectations comparable to those that white workers might reasonably harbor or consider a matter of right on the basis of their whiteness alone. To those who questioned the morality of this logic, farm employers replied that it was not the puny will of man, but immutable nature that had ordained that the relationship of the Chinese to whites be one of servant to master. William Blackwood, a leading farm employer in the state, observed with apparent guilelessness, quote, the laborers of China are born to servitude. It has become ingrained in their natures. They never seek to rise above it. And lest anyone suggest that man might somehow undo nature's plan in this regard, Blackwood added, that, quote, no power of any government could effect a change in this respect. The simple and only question affecting our welfare, that is the welfare of agribusinessmen in California, is can we use him, that is to say the Chinaman, profitably and develop our industries without contamination? That is, exploit the labor, but in such a way that you don't expose yourself to cultural pollution by having someone in your midst that you're relying upon who is not like you and can never be like you. Using his own and his fellow farm employers' initial experiences with Chinese workers as his guide, Blackwood unhesitatingly answered in the affirmative. To those who still remain doubtful, Blackwood suggested a reassuring analogy. As a class of laborers, he noted, the Chinese in California have heretofore occupied precisely the same position in the body politic that the peasantry of Europe do at home. By home, he's referring to Europe. The Chinese in California have no voice in governmental affairs. Neither have the peasantry of Europe. The Chinese of California live on or near the lands of their employers. So do the peasantry of Europe. The Chinese are sober, temperate, and industrious. So are the peasantry of Europe. The Chinese in California do not aspire to rise above the position of common laborers. Neither do the peasantry of Europe. The Chinese do not seek to affiliate socially with a better class in California. Neither do the peasantry of Europe seek such a social affiliation. With a large class of cheap laborers in large supply, Blackwood argued, it would be, quote, beyond the powers of an ordinary mind to compute just how far California's large-scale agricultural enterprises could be profitably pushed, or the amount of wealth these industries would create in the state. With such a class of laborers around him, he said, the farmer, the orchardist, the vineyardist could retire to rest at night feeling secure. Popular opposition to the further importation of Chinese workers, which manifested itself in the passage of the blatantly racist Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, denied farm employers in California the workers who they thought were the best suited to meet their needs. But it did not dissuade them from their conclusion that workers of color were likely to have those characteristics that met the were most likely to have those characteristics that met the unique requirements of industrialized agriculture. And by the 1920s, there was general agreement in California agribusiness circles that Mexican workers would do if they couldn't have the Chinese workers who were their first choice. This change in attitude derived from two simple facts. Mexicans were available in abundant supply, and employers soon realized that social, political, economic, and cultural forces combined in California to render Mexican farm workers as powerless as they had the Chinese a generation before. Of course, the special benefit that derived from a farm labor system that capitalized on the powerlessness of socially marginal groups was that it afforded farm employers nearly exclusive access to a large force of workers whose occupational captivity was maintained without resort to coercive schemes that would have directly affronted America's democratic sensibilities. That is, you didn't have to institute slavery to have things your way economically. You could simply count on the enduring racism of all categories of classes, the whites in California, to see to it that these people never left that occupation and were always available to farm workers on terms dictated to farm employers on terms dictated by farm employers. By the 20th century, employment in California's large-scale agriculture had come to mean irregular work, constant movement, low wages, squalid working and living conditions, social isolation, emotional deprivation, and individual powerlessness so profound as to make occupational advancement a virtual impossibility. We have the sense that if you practice all the American virtues, you're sober and industrious and ambitious, hardworking, and that is, you commend yourself to others on every conceivable basis, that somehow that you will be rewarded for the effort. There are circumstances in the history of this country when that's simply not true. It wasn't true, of course, under slavery, and it wasn't true under the system of agricultural labor that developed in California. To the typical large-scale farm employer in California, seasonal farm workers had become faceless, nameless units of production. They were pairs of hands, indispensable to the success and profitability of the employer's business, but with no greater affinity for the land they worked than the urban factory operative had for his workstation. Yet agribusinessmen in California were always astute enough politically to understand that they could not be truly secure in a labor system enforced only by tradition and custom. Not until the system that they had devised was endorsed and codified in state and federal law, they believed, could they be fully secure in their labor practices. Utterly convinced, as Chris has noted earlier, that they were in the grip of unique economic forces that gave them no choice other than to reduce the workers that served them to a condition of abject powerlessness and servitude. Farm employers in California used their unrivaled political power to ensure that their private policy in regard to farm workers became, to the fullest extent possible, the public policy of the state of California, and then later, of course, of the nation. Their success in that regard is legendary. In a way, it's sort of a test of why we're here today talking about this so long after this system came into being. The influence that California's agribusiness industry was able to exert on the public policies affecting their industry has been profound and enduring. They have routinely succeeded in bending federal immigration laws to their special needs, and by exploiting the public's ignorance of just how profoundly industrialized agriculture differs from family farming, that is, the agrarian pursuits extolled by Jefferson and others, they have succeeded in peddling to the Congress and to state legislatures the outrageous fiction that farm employers are not really employers and that farm workers are not really workers. Starting in the 1930s with the passage of the National Labor Relations Act and continuing at both the state and federal levels in nearly every piece of labor and employment legislation enacted since that time, that is, since the 1930s, farm employers have been expressly exempted from the duties and obligations imposed by law on non-agricultural employers. And farm workers have been expressly denied the rights and protections conferred by law on their non-agricultural counterparts. Inaugurated and sustained by nothing more or less compelling than the brute, uncountered political power of agribusiness interests, the degrading and destructive system of agricultural labor relations built on these cynical fictions is, in my judgment, an affront to simple fairness and a stain on American democracy. And its reform ought to be the urgent concern of every citizen in New York State and every citizen in the nation who is committed to a society based on social, political, and economic justice for everybody. That's the end of my formal remarks, but I want to now say something about the current situation. As Chris noted in his introduction, I was asked by former governor, Mario Cuomo, back in the early 1990s, to chair a special task force which was created for the express purpose of looking into the circumstances of farm workers' lives in New York State and to look at the nature of the relationship between employers and workers in New York State agriculture. The committee was made up of faculty members from various schools at Cornell University. You know, Cornell is only a quasi-private university. Four of the colleges at Cornell, and you probably all know this, are state-supported schools. The College of Veterinary Medicine, which is the leading vet school in the country, is a state-supported school. The College of Agriculture and Life Sciences is state-supported. I mean, Cornell University is the land-grant university of the state of New York, so it's appropriate that the ag school was placed there. The College of Human Ecology is a state-supported school, and the school that I teach in, the School of Industrial Labor Relations, is state-supported. And so the governor had the idea that he would risk the political flack that he got from farm employer interests by putting together a task force that would inquire into the circumstances of farm workers' lives and the character of labor relations in New York State agriculture. So we had faculty members from the ag school, from human ecology, and I, along with some of my colleagues from the School of Industrial Labor Relations, comprised this task force. We spent several months, hired a professional research staff, and spent several months acquiring evidence, conducting interviews, not just in New York, but because this was going to be a comparative study, that is, we were going to compare the circumstances of farm workers in New York State with the conditions obtained for farm workers in California and Arizona and all the other highly industrialized agricultural states of the Union, Florida, and so forth. We did interviews all around the country. Interviewed people who were involved in agricultural unionism, interviewed farm employers, at least those who would speak to us, spoke to interviewed representatives from the American Farm Bureau Federation and various state affiliates of the Farm Bureau, wrote a report in which we shifted the focus away from a detailed description of the precise level of degradation being suffered by farm workers. I mean, you run out of adjectives after a while in describing how bad things are. But moreover, it seemed to me from the very beginning, I missed the point, the focus needed to be on, in this report, needed to be on why it was that agricultural workers as an occupational group had been denied equal protection under New York State laws. I mean, I think most Americans, most New Yorkers believe that one of the obligations that government has is to treat everybody equally, to afford the same kinds of protections, to afford the same sorts of benefits to all citizens on a basis of equality without regard to considerations of class or occupation and so forth. So we argued in favor of reforms that would result in the elimination from all state labor laws all of those special exemptions granted to farm employers, that is, all of those exemptions that said farm employers are not really bound by the provisions of this law because they're not really employers like industrial employers are, and also all of those provisions in the laws that expressly denied to farm workers equal rights and protections under New York State labor legislation. As soon as the report arrived in Albany, it was dead. The governor, at the time he appointed the committee, saw an opening to do this kind of thing. By the time we had finished our report in the spring of 1991, that window had closed, and it was another political season, and the governor, though he was a man of humane instincts, was not going to run the political risk involved in defending this constituency, because this constituency could not reward its champions. If you're going to help this category of workers, you had to do it because you thought there was a principle involved. That is, you were moved by this notion that the government ought to be fair and equal in its treatment of people. If you did the normal political calculus that most politicians do, that is to say, you measured the likely risks of your association with this effort with the likely political benefits, the risks far outweighed the potential benefits. As a consequence, no one, almost no one, would step forward and support this. But even more disappointing than that, because that was a predictable reaction, was the New York State labor movement, that is to say, that institutional entity that embodies the organized power of America, of New York State workers, had no interest in this. Most labor leaders in New York State were unacquainted with the fact that farm workers were not covered by existing laws. But they were also well aware of all of the failures that had occurred in the past. You know, the history of American worker organization is littered with a wreckage of organizations that try to organize the workers who are in society who are most desperately in need of organizations. It's always those workers who sort of lag behind the rest. And today, finally, you've got some emphasis on organizing workers who are not in the middle or at the top of the wage hierarchy, the occupational hierarchy. There are people down toward the bottom. Janitors in California just won a big strike, and the fruits of this victory will be a few cents more an hour. I mean, the kind of wage increase that a carpenter or an auto worker or others would scoff at, I mean, it's not, wouldn't be worth the trouble. But for those chronically impoverished members of the working poor, that 30 cents more an hour will make some kind of measurable difference in the quality of his or her life. Hotel workers are now among the most active workers. Even a class as degraded as college university teaching assistants, and I think we know what they're like. it almost brings tears to my eyes to think about teaching assistants. They're organized. They're doing it successfully. The National Labor Relations Board recently acknowledged that under the National Labor Relations Act, these workers, these higher education workers, graduate students who employed as research and teaching assistants, have the right to organize under federal labor laws. And when when New York University challenged this, their challenge was rebuffed by this federal agency. And it's very likely, I think, that a union will emerge among these workers at NYU, and that will become only the first triumph in a succession of triumphs of workers of this sort across the country. Because the governor had no interest in pursuing the recommendations we made in this task force report, and because no one was willing to step up and run any kind of significant political risk on behalf of workers who could not reward them in any way, because the job of organizing agricultural workers, even if you won bargaining rights, that the work of organizing agricultural workers is just horrifically difficult, in the end, the easiest thing to do is what we had always done, which is to return to our policy of studied neglect. You know, premeditated neglect has been the essential strategy of society in dealing with the problems that the farm workers confront. And Governor Cuomo, despite the fact he's a decent person, a humane person, I think a person who's truly engaged by moral and ethical issues, simply could not do the political calculus in a way that caused him to conclude that this was a fight worth fighting. The power lined up against him on the other side was tremendous and was daunting, and why bother? Recently, as a result of a series of extraordinary editorials in the New York Daily News, the hell's the New York Daily News care about this? I mean, they don't have many readers among migrant farm workers, seasonal farm workers in New York State. But they decided this is an issue that they wanted to address. And they called me and they asked for a copy of this report we'd done. And I did long interviews with the editorial board of the newspaper. And they began writing these editorials. And they began hammering away at people. And they began confronting everybody that they believed was in any way complicit in this effort to keep farm workers from the protections that other workers had, and they had remarkable results. They have caused politicians who are otherwise oblivious to this issue to suddenly take account of it. They have embarrassed the labor movement in New York State into making this an important issue, one that they're willing to take some risks on behalf of. They have angered a number of politicians. There were hearings held in Albany, joint legislative hearings of two Senate committees, the Senate Agricultural Committee and the Senate Labor Committee, and I submitted testimony before that committee. And what I had to say apparently greatly offended the sensibilities of the woman who's chair of the Senate Agricultural Committee, a state senator from the Syracuse area named Nancy Lorraine Hoffman. She had been a Democrat, but became a Republican, and as a consequence of the switch, was appointed by the leadership of the Republican leadership of the state Senate to chair the Agriculture Committee. A few weeks ago, Cornell every spring has this this reception they host in Albany for the purpose of glad-handing legislators and governor and all kinds of people, always, of course, with the same purpose, which is to tell them how important we are, what good work we're doing, and to get them to give us more money than they're otherwise disposed to give us. And we're really good at this. I mean, we're really good at the president of the university and the provost and everybody, all the deans, they flock to Albany. Busloads of selected faculty go to Albany. They've got wonderful food and you know, lots to drink. And you invite everybody of any consequence in Albany, all the members of the state Senate, the state assembly, all the movers and shakers there, and then you tell them how important we are and how we could use more money to good advantage. I'm usually invited to go to that thing, but I wasn't invited this year. And when my colleagues returned, the dean of my school said that he was approached by the president of the university, the provost, who had just had a conversation with Senator Nancy Lorraine Hoffman. She wanted to know why it was that Cornell University was squandering precious resources on some guy who was presuming to attack the integrity of politicians in New York State over this farm labor issue. And why was it that Cornell University never did anything for agriculture in New York State or for agricultural employers? I'm sorry I wasn't there. I mean, it's so preposterous that it could only have made me laugh, and it certainly wouldn't have made me mad. But we have an agricultural college that over the decades has spent and continues to spend hundreds of millions of dollars directly in the service of the state's agriculture. And I don't object to that. I mean, I don't have any objection to that. My objection is to maintaining the prosperity of New York State agriculture on the backs of those least able to throw the burden off their backs. As long as it's spread around among all the taxpayers, among all the citizens of this state, that I think family farming especially is worth preserving. I don't even mind providing subsidies to more commercial scale of agriculture in the state. But it's got to be done on a basis which no longer presumes that the prosperity of New York State agriculture can only be achieved at the cost of the degradation and the inequality of farm workers.
That was Professor Cleet Daniels of the Institute for Labor History and Research at Cornell.
Genesee County, please stand. How about the Orleans, Monroe County?
On May 2nd, farm workers and their supporters from all over New York State converged on Albany for Farm Worker Advocacy Day. They demanded the end to exclusionary laws which deny farm workers the basic rights accorded to other workers in the state, including the right to collective bargaining, overtime pay, protection from toxic chemicals, and a mandatory day of rest. An understanding of working class solidarity is at the heart of this movement.
We have come here today as farm workers, as advocates, as concerned citizens, as outraged human beings. The liberation of farm workers is not about liberating only those who do farm work. The liberation of farm workers is about all of us. I found a quote many years ago by an indigenous woman, and she says, "If you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come here because your liberation is bound up with mine, then stay." That's why we're all here today. We inherited a system that pushed people into a river to drown. And very good-hearted people came to their rescue. So people created food pantries because there wasn't a decent living wage. Health programs were created. These were all great efforts, saving drowning people. And it was not social justice. Yet it's our legal system that created the conditions that pushed people in that river to drown. And this truth transformed pity into anger. It transformed compassion into action. And so farm workers and advocates started together, educating each other through the education. Additional community people came on board, and they said, "This is not the America I learned about."
Protesters marched to the steps of the Capitol and held a rally where farm workers, labor organizers, and legislators addressed the crowd.
Hello, my name is Jill. I'm a dairy worker
from
Niagara County. It's hard to put into words how I feel to be here today. All of us farm workers appreciate all of you getting up so early. There are many farm workers who also wanted to be here today, but due to working could not be here. Like my husband who's back home working in the dairy farm. I have my two sons with me here today, Jason and Justin. And thank you to your support, there are three laws that have been passed. Drinking water, toilets in the field, and equal minimum wage.
Espacio Alcantara is with CETA, the Independent Farm Worker Center in Florida, New York. CETA serves farm workers' organizing efforts in lieu of a formal union.
Los patrones están organizados.
The owners are organized.
Y por eso ellos tienen poder.
And that's why they have power.
Pero ahora CETA está organizada también.
And now CETA is organized too.
Y contando con cada uno de ustedes.
And counting on every one of you.
Contando con las uniones.
Counting on the union.
Contando con las iglesias.
Counting on the churches.
Contando con los estudiantes.
Counting on the students.
Contando con la gente que tiene conciencia social.
Counting on people who have a social conscience.
Vamos a hacer cada día más fuerte en Nueva York.
We're going to be every day, we're going to grow stronger.
Y vamos a transformar la historia de los trabajadores agrícolas.
And we are going to change the story, the history of the farm workers.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Se siente, campesino está presente. Se siente, campesino está presente.
Farm Workers Advocacy Day began in 1996 to win the rights to drinking water and toilet facilities for farm workers. Senator Nicholas Spano has been instrumental in passing legislation that improves the conditions of farm workers. He spoke to the crowd assembled on the Capitol steps.
There's something different here today in the Capitol. There's a different sound that we have here. And that's the sound of the shackles being removed off the backs of the farm workers in this state.
Yeah!
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be mine.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.